All right, this show brought to you in part by SimpliSafe. If you have 30 minutes, you never have to worry about break-ins ever again. Just go to simplisafe.com/Adam, get all the sensors you need, all the help you need as well to set it up. Custom systems going to show up post-haste at simplisafe.com/Adam. Senator from Florida, Marco Rubio. Very interesting conversation, one-on-one. First, there's Geico. Do you own? Do you rent your home? Sure you do. And it can be hard work. You know what's easy? Bundling your policies with Geico. Geico makes it easy to bundle your homeowners or renters insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing, too, because you have so much to do already around your home. Why not make it easy? Go to geico.com, get a quote, and see just how much you could save. It's Geico easy. Visit geico.com today. That's geico.com.
Have you ever heard that story that Napoleon used the Egyptian Sphinx for target practice and shot its nose off? Or maybe you've heard that a French astrologer named Nostradamus correctly predicted nearly 500 years of human history. Or maybe someone told you that the legendary blues guitarist Robert Johnson sold his soul to the devil at a crossroads in Mississippi. These stories are what I like to call historical myths. Great little tales that may or may not have any basis in historical fact. On Our Fake History, we explore these historical myths and try to determine what's fact, what's fiction, and what is such a good story, it simply must be told. If you dig stories about death-obsessed emperors, lost civilizations, desperate sieges, voodoo black magic, and famous historical figures you thought you knew, then Our Fake History might just be your new favorite podcast. Still not sure? Then stick around to the end of the episode today to hear a teaser episode of Our Fake History. If you dig it, then subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
From Corolla One Studios in Glendale, California, this is the Adam Carolla Show. Today, Adam sits down one-on-one with the United States Senator from Florida, Marco Rubio. And now, a man who likes to talk about how people are all talk, Adam Carolla.
Yeah, get it on. Got to get on the church, make it on Monday. Get it on and welcome to the show. We got a little one-on-one going with Florida Senator Marco Rubio, who you guys all know. Thanks for joining us, Marco Rubio.
Good to be with you. Happy to be here.
Well, we're in a tale of two different states because I'm out in California and you're out in Florida. And seems to be a lot of people are leaving California and going to Florida. And it also seems like instead of fixing California, our governor's just trying to do an anti-Florida campaign, which you can tell me how bad Florida is until you're blue in the face. But I'd still like you to fix California, the state you run. Do you have thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, California to me, and it's sad because it's a beautiful place, but it's basically like what happens when you take every woke and crazy idea that some professor at a college campus or some activist in that case thinks is good and you turn it into public policy. And you say, oh, let's get rid of the police departments. Let's not arrest people that commit crimes. Let's provide these trailers for people that are homeless right there on the street in front of people's homes. Let's turn our schools into indoctrination camps. Let's raise taxes to the point where you can't live anymore. Let's be a state that welcomes people coming illegally into our country and actually provides them benefits that citizens don't have. You take all these ideas that sound really good, I guess, at the faculty club and you turn it into public policy, and then you ruin a state that frankly, 30 years ago was, something that a lot of Americans wanted to be a part of, and there's a lot of glamour attached to it. So it's sad, and hopefully that'll change, but obviously it's going to take some time, and it isn't going to happen as long as that guy's the governor.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's like California is an example of a state that has embraced the most progressive bad ideas. And you know, I'm not that partisan in that, you know, every idea that is put forward by a Democrat is bad. But then there's the left, and the left has a ton of bad ideas. And so we've embraced the most bad ideas, and that's why people are fleeing here and going to Texas and Florida and Tennessee and many other places that have embraced sort of the least bad progressive ideas. There's always going to be some bad progressive ideas in whatever state you're in. We just happen to have the most in California. Maybe New York is second, and that's where people are leaving as well.
Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting because you raised partisanship. I actually don't think that that this is traditional partisanship. So for the last 30 or 40 years, you know, most of my life, the American politics has operated within a consensus. And there's a, you know, there's a left guardrail and a right guardrail. And so, yeah, you know, we have different ideas. And some one side thinks taxes should be a little higher. The other side thinks there should be less regulation, but generally operated in this consensus. What's happened is that paradigm has completely shifted. The Democratic Party has become the party of affluent progressives and Marxist misfit activists. They've taken over the party. And so you have millions of Americans, many of whom have been Democrats, voted for Democrats, union members, what have you. But they're working people. And they're like, yeah, you know, I might be a little liberal on some issues, but I'm not insane. I still have common sense. I still believe in things like reality. And they have, and they see a party that doesn't just ignore them and ignores their concerns, but prioritizes all of these ideas that belong to a small group of people that have a lot of power, the elite group of affluent people, but they don't live on the same planet. And their ideas don't work for real people. In fact, many times these ideas aren't just bad ideas. They hurt working people. They hurt everyday people. So everyday people are having their concerns ignored and their common sense constantly violated by the political party that movement has captured. Now, that hopefully will change. I think we're a stronger country when we have two political parties that disagree on a left-right spectrum, but operate within the constraints of common sense and reality. We don't have that right now. And unfortunately, the Democratic Party has been captured by this element that is just not the majority of the country.
Yeah, you know, if you talk to people, they'll go, well, the people on the left, you know, the Democrats have been taken hostage by, you know, these college professor, tenured college professor, left-wing progressive San Francisco lunatics. And they go, well, what about the right? The right's been taken over by a bunch of Hitlerian white supremacists. And it's like, well, they're not setting policy based on what the white supremacists and the neo-Nazis are saying, even if they are on that side. Meaning, I would say to people all the time, it's like, oh, there's bad people over here, and then there's bad people over there. It's like, yes, they're bad people on each side. But the Republican Party isn't taking its marching orders from the Klan. The left and the Democrats are listening and enacting a lot of policies from the fringy nut jobs. And I think that's the problem of the time we're living in.
Yeah, my last name is Rubio. So if they were setting policy based on the Klan and the Republican Party, I probably wouldn't have won very many elections, much less have a place here. Look, there are people throughout the American political spectrum that have all kinds of ideas, including, you know, people whose ideas, they claim to be Republicans, but I don't agree with their ideas. And in some case, I think their ideas might be dangerous. That's not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about here is a Democratic Party whose donor base and activist base and frankly, staff base, I mean, the people that work their campaigns and oftentimes they come from a different world. They're generally more affluent, increasingly non-minority. I mean, and not that that is necessarily the issue, but they claim to be a party that defends minority. But their views are largely the views of whiter, more affluent people that live in some bubbles around this country. And these are people that $5 gas doesn't bother as much. So they have the luxury to prioritize some other issues. For the people in the real world, the everyday people, the small business owner that are trying to raise a family and work hard, they may have opinions on some of those issues. But there's no way those issues will ever become a priority when, frankly, you know, you have 50, 60% of Americans now living paycheck to paycheck. And it's not like people talk about inflation. It's not just inflation. It's inflation on the essentials. Because one thing is, you know, flat screen TV, the new one that came out, too expensive. Okay, I'm not talking about, we're talking about food, housing, clothing. You know, these are the basic gasoline. These are the basics and now back to school supplies. So that's the core there. And those we're not even having a debate about those topics. That's the bigger problem. The people who control Congress, which are Democratic leaders, That's not been what they prioritized for the last 2 years. They prioritized a fake voting rights crisis in Georgia. They prioritized social issues that, you know, transgender rights, all these things that may matter to some people. And, you know, but they're not the priority, that they're not the biggest threat to the Republic or our way of life. And that is where I think you start to lose touch with people.
Well, you know, there's a Home Depot a block away from where I'm sitting. If I walked down the street and went into the Home Depot, I would imagine it would be filled with Republicans and Democrats. And if I asked, just randomly stopped 100 of them in the plumbing aisle and said, what do you care more about? The price of gas, the price of beef, the price of eggs and school choice or transgender rights? Every single one of them would say the price of gas and beef, and none of them would say transgender rights. So why is that platform building a dream on the thing that the people in the Home Depot don't give a crap about?
Because the people at Home Depot, by and large, are not the people that are donating on Act Blue. They're not the people that are protesting in the streets and threatening to burn down cities every time they don't get their way. They're not the people that are blocking traffic over climate change. They're not the people that work these campaigns. They're not the activist base that claims to represent underrepresented people. And that's where the base and the energy of the Democratic Party has come from. And so that my point is that's what's dominated it, right? It is dominated by people that are not at Home Depot. They live in the Upper West Side. They live in East Hollywood. You know, that's where they live. And frankly, they have enough affluence to make these things a priority. And then you have sort of a corporate mainstream media that goes along with it, because many of the people that run that, not to mention corporate America, agree with some of those things. And so they prioritize these issues. And so you talk about transgender rights. Look, I think every American is entitled to decency, to respect, to all the basic equality under the law that we're all entitled to. But 0.5% of this country is not entitled to change everything for everyone, for the other 99.5% of the nation. And yet that's the argument they're making on that issue, along with the fact that it just ignores some pretty basic truths and common sense. It hasn't just changed policy, it's changed language. You have the AP and other major entities now refuse to write pregnant women. They'll write pregnant people.
Right.
And as of, I don't know, the time of this taping, I just checked right before I came on, according to the experts, throughout 5,500 years of recorded history, every person who's ever been pregnant happened to be a biological woman. And maybe that one day that will change, but so far it has not. And so when we talk about pregnant people, it's a fiction. But the language has changed. There's these guys, a brand new language. There are words I do not understand, like Latinx. I thought Latinx was like a band or something. I didn't know, or some club. I didn't know what, I've never heard that term in my life, except from people in Washington that are in politics.
Yeah, well, it's obviously super condescending because it's a bunch of middle-aged, semi-well-off white people telling Latin people what they need to start calling themselves. It's kind of that Joe Biden, you know, if you ain't black, you ain't Democrat, you know, that kind of stuff. It's like, you guys never stop talking about racism. Who's the one who sounds like a racist in this equation, number one? Number two, you take something as simple as defund the police. To your point, if you live in Malibu or you live in the Palisades or you live in Beverly Hills, you can defund the police all you want. It's never going to touch you. It's never coming to your front door. It's the people in the bad neighborhoods that are hurt by defunding the police. And that's sort of the point you've been making throughout this conversation, correct?
Yeah, and it's maybe that defund the police was the beginning of it, but I think that the most damaging thing now has, in addition to that whole attitude, has been the rise of these prosecutors across the country who unilaterally decided not to prosecute entire categories of crime. And so when it's very simple equation, again, going back to common sense, if you will not arrest criminals, then it will be on the street. And the message that you're sending if you don't arrest people is we're not going to punish crime. There's no consequences for it. And we start to look like the movie The Purge, right? Because you're basically telling people these things we won't prosecute. Plus, you're releasing them. And one of the reasons why mandatory sentences, and I'm not saying they're always perfect, but mandatory sentences work is because they take people who have a proven record of and tendency to commit crimes, career criminals, and you put them away. You are removing the supply of criminals on the street. But if you're arresting someone and immediately releasing them back into the street, and then after that, you're dropping the charges, you created not just an incentive, the capability of that person to create more crimes, but you've actually sent a message to a bunch of other people that there are no consequences for certain crimes. And that just creates the spirit of criminality that begins to spread in ways that are disastrous. I mean, every day brings stories of something you never would have seen 10 years ago, but now you do.
What, in your estimation, is going on with Joe Biden in that the pitch for Joe Biden is, you know, Uncle Joe, slow and steady, guy's been around for a million years. We're going to tact back toward the middle. The adults are in the room. We're going to ease up on the rhetoric, and we're going to get a moderate guy because this country wants to be governed by a moderate. So everyone's hair was on fire with Trump, and we're going to go the opposite of Trump. We're going to go a very mild-mannered, moderate guy. He's not going to do anything radical. We're just going to get back to a country that we sort of recognize from, you know, 25 years ago, and a tempered, moderate president. And Joe seems to have just sort of gone in with all the lunatics on the left, at least from a policy standpoint. And it doesn't really make sense to me. Certainly, it's not consistent with the promise of the campaign, although he said many radical things during it. But that he was being pitched, certainly by the news apparatus, that he's just slow and steady, wins the race. We got an adult back in the room. Everyone can relax. And then he just went down this road. And I keep thinking sort of what's in it for him. And these aren't his policies, but he's going along with all of them. Is he unable to just go, hey, man, this is not what I said I was going to do?
Yeah, well, I don't think that this is anything like what he was 20 years ago when he was in the Senate. It's also not the same party. So I think there's two things. Yeah, he sold his campaign was that he was going to be a bridge between the past and the future. Sort of like a caretaker. He didn't promise to be some revolutionary leader. He promised to basically be a guy that would bring everything back to normal, settle everything down as America transitioned from one era to the other. And instead, what he's learned upon his election is his office is staffed by people from the New Democrat Party, the modern Democrat Party. The activists that generate the energy behind their party are insisting upon these things. And so you have people coming to you and saying, okay, we've got to listen to these people because they're the ones that got us, or they're the ones that knocked on doors, or the people that gave us money. And so the first thing out of the gate is $1.9 trillion of spending, which even Democrat economists were telling them was going to ramp up inflation. You know, if you create more supply with more government money, more demand with more government money, but your supply is still short, you know, more demand, less supply, higher prices. And that's what happened. Then they moved. They pivoted to this voting rights issue again, another thing insisted upon by the radicals in the Democratic Party. And then he went as far as to do something really uncharacteristic of Joe Biden throughout his career, to accuse everyone who opposed that law of being no better than George Wallace and the Jim Crow era leaders of the 1960s. I mean, just really outrageous, over the top stuff. From there, he proceeded to try to pass the Build Back Better, which was basically a hodgepodge of every far left pipe dream, all thrown and cobbled together into one bill. Even now, this bill they're putting forward, cynically, they call it the Inflation Act. It isn't. It raises a bunch of taxes on a lot of people that aren't rich and businesses that aren't big. And it's going to use it to fund a bunch of Green New Deal projects, not to mention tackle urgent issues like, for example, you know, racist highways and plant more trees and things that not and you know, subsidize these electric cars that most Americans will not be driving anytime in the near future. Meanwhile, you know, like 96-97% of the automobiles in America get no help as a result of this. All of it because he is now the head of a modern Democratic Party. And from a staffing activist perspective, they are all from the far left. That Democratic Party of the 80s, 90s, whatever, is gone. I mean, it's just not there anymore.
Is this, you tell me what you think of this analogy. It'll be a little rough around the edges, but tell me if you think it's generally true. Joe Biden, let's forget about politics. It's like he said, I'm not a vegan. I'm not a vegetarian. I like a hamburger every once in a while. I like a nice T-bone steak on a Saturday night. And that's who I am. And then he got into office and he was surrounded by vegetarians. And he's like, I'm going to have a double-double I'll take a cheeseburger. And they went, you know, we got some lentil bean soup that you maybe enjoy more. And he was like, oh, okay, yeah, I'll try that. And then we got some veggie subs. And the next thing you know, he's a vegetarian because everyone around him is essentially a vegetarian. And that's kind of what they're feeding him. And then also, who wants to argue with everyone who's a vegetarian like all day? Like, did he go in as a carnivore and he was just converted by all the vegetarians around him?
Yeah, listen, I think he went in as a carnivore that was friends with a bunch of vegetarians. And what he found is that these people aren't just vegetarians. They don't want you to wear leather.
Right.
They don't want you. I mean, you can't. They don't want you to even watch movies where bad things happen to animals. They not only do they not think anyone should eat meat, they don't think that we should allow cattle because that hurts the environment. In essence, it goes well beyond vegetarians. Again, it goes back to the point. If someone wants to be a vegetarian, they can be. I don't think there's anything inherently evil about it. This is way beyond vegetarianism. And by the way, these are also the people that are offended if you're not a vegetarian.
Right.
I mean, it's not that they're a vegetarian. They get offended that you're not a vegetarian.
Well,
or that,
no, you know, not only, it's more than offended. They won't tolerate you.
They won't. No, exactly.
Having a hamburger.
Right. Because if you eat meat, you're not just doing something that they think is unhealthy and they won't do. You're actually an evil person.
Right.
Because a living creature had to be put to death, and as a result, in order for you to have that meat. And by the way, before they were killed, they were messing up the environment because they released too much of that gas or whatever. I mean, it's just that level of the other direction. Furthermore, you're no longer allowed to even say the word meat, right? I mean, that's the other thing they're saying. Now that word has been changed as well. And so we're using an analogy, but basically this has gone well beyond. I think people have a right to believe whatever they want, and we have a republic to work out those differences. But these guys want to change the concept of true and not true, right and wrong, what words we can use, who's allowed to speak and what you're allowed to say. They even want to change what you're able to tell jokes about, which is defeats the purpose of comedy. If the only people that you're allowed to offend are Trump supporters and white men, that it's not going to be very funny after a while.
Let's turn to Cuba, where your family's from. I've not heard a lot about Cuba in the last several months. I'm not in Florida. I'm not a Rubio, so maybe I'm missing some stuff. I know, you know, Fidel's gone, but his brother took his place. Cuba, it seems incomprehensible to me that it would remain the way it is for the many years. I mean, you know, Fidel Castro had a 50-year run, never got assassinated or poisoned or... You know, it just continues. I mean, it's literally 50 some odd years now, right?
Yeah, longer than that. It's almost 60 years. But so here's the way I would describe Cuba. They signed up for an economic model that doesn't work. And it doesn't just not work. It's really catastrophic. There's no other country really in the world, right? Not even Venezuela, which is really more of a corrupt narco state than it is a Marxist one. They're the only people still sort of following this Marxist textbook, which clearly does not work, but they can't abandon it. What they'd like to do is they don't want to be a prosperous country. They just need to provide enough, a level of prosperity, just high enough for their people to be happy and calm and not be angry at the government and not have everyone leave. But they can't. They're going to have to open up their economy for that to happen. But the reason why they don't want to open up the economy is because when you open up the economy, you begin to lose control over people. They may not have much, but if everything you have is provided by the government, your education, your limited food, your medicine, your access to medicine, if everything you have you depend on the government for, then they have a tremendous amount of leverage over you. And that's what's happening. Now, they had hoped that this opening with Obama, which proved to be a disaster, would allow them to create a little bit of economic activity, but that they would control and, in essence, give us the money and we'll make sure that people get it. But it was never designed to advance those people's lives. It's just make sure they eat enough so they don't protest and they don't all leave. Well, none of that has worked out. And then on top of that, it's been exacerbated by COVID and the loss of tourism. You know, now Russians were a big part of their tourism. They're not traveling a lot these days, Russians. So the result is that they're in a total catastrophe. So here's something most people don't realize. A significant percentage of the people who are presenting themselves at the southern border and crossing are Cuban. They go to Nicaragua, which allows them to travel them without a visa, and then they make that trek towards the border. And already this year alone, the first 7 months of this year, almost 8 months of this year, more people have come to the U.S. illegally from Cuba in the first 8 months of this year than did throughout the entire Mario boat lift, which was a traumatic moment in the early 80s. They have lost, you know, 1 to 2% of the country has left just in the last year. 160,000 people, so 16 million, 160,000 people, over 1% of the population of the country has left. And these are the people that are young and healthy enough to survive a journey such as this. So it's a perhaps the most difficult time in Cuba's history, even worse than when the Soviet Union collapsed. And they just have people there that are incompetent Marxists. It's, you can be incompetent or you can be a Marxist, but if you're an incompetent Marxist, that's a disastrous combination.
Well, you brought up the southern border. What is the play on the southern border with the Biden administration, and what's the end game? I can't figure out what the plan
is.
I guess, like, I, you know, it happens a lot where somebody says, you know, fences don't work, tear this down, National Guard's not going to work, none of it works. Okay, but then what does work? And the answer is never an answer. It's just sort of what doesn't work. And so is the end game just going to be more illegal migration through the southern border than we've ever seen? And then to what benefit is that to the Biden administration, especially because of, and you're probably well aware of this, the way voters, Latin voters, are turning on the Democratic Party in droves recently. I mean, just, you know, I can't remember all the numbers offhand, but they would win lavishly with, you know, I mean, they do very well with African-American voters and then very well with Hispanic voters. And both those numbers are dropping, but the Hispanic voters are dropping fast.
Yeah. So let's unpack two things. The first, you mentioned that fences don't work and the National Guard doesn't work, because that was their argument when Trump tried to do it. Now it's not the National Guard. That's not what their job is. We don't need a fence. That doesn't really work. On January 6th, when a guy broke in here with Speedos and, and horns, and we had it, it was a terrible day, no doubt about it. What did they put up around the Capitol? Fences.
Right.
Immediately. I mean, like within 12 hours, there was fences around this place. And for a month and a half, we had National Guards from all over the country sleeping here and full-time, you know, duty here. So I guess fences and National Guard doesn't work on our border, but if the Capitol and the people who work here feel threatened, then it does work. The second thing about the border is pretty simple, and that is if people believe that if they get in, they're going to be allowed to stay, they're going to come. And they believe it because it's true. I mean, these are human beings. They respond to incentive and word of mouth. And this is not a theory. I didn't read about it in the latest edition of some magazine. I know people who have relatives that are coming illegally. And the reason is simple. They know that if they come across the border and they turn themselves in, they will be processed. They will be given a notice to appear at some future court hearing, and they will be released. They will be handed over to some charity, and that charity will give them a cash card and will transport them to the city where their relatives are. And then they're gone. And you know, people know it. These people call back home and they said, hey, we made it, and more people will come. So it is very simple. They believe if they come in, they'll be allowed to stay. And there's the perception. I mean, so if Trump was hard on the border, Biden said, I'm going to do the opposite of Trump. The word got out in every country where people wanted to come here that it was going to be easier to come. That this was, and if you came here, there was actually going to be some change in the law in the future that would allow you to get legalized. And it created an incentive for people to come. And that's what's happening. And that's what's happening. If we announce tomorrow anyone who wants to come to America can come, at least 100 million people will try to come. At least 100 million people will try to come. So that's the starting point. So we have to have a system that decides who can come, when they can come, and how they can come. And if you follow that process, we will always be a country that welcomes immigrants through a process that Americans have decided is good for our country at that time in our history. But if you don't follow that process, you shouldn't be allowed to stay. And some of these are very sad stories. But, if, you know, like every country in the world, we have to be able to deal with it. So you ask, what's the end game for Biden? He doesn't have one. The problem is there are activists in that party who believe we should not have a border. They do not believe. They may get lip service to it for political purposes, but they don't think borders. They think borders are artificial, that we're all citizens of the world, and that people should be able to live wherever they want. That's how they truly believe. And they'll, some of them will argue that openly, and that's why I talk about abolishing ICE and not. So, and even others will say, well, I believe we should have immigration laws. We just shouldn't enforce them, which is the same as saying, let's not have them. Now, you ask about Hispanic voters. Let me say this. I do not believe, and I've said this for a long time, that for most Americans of Hispanic descent, their primary identity is their ethnicity. It's a big part of your identity. It's a big part of my identity. You know, we celebrate Christmas on the 24th, not the 25th. We eat a roast pig on the 24th. The music people might listen to is different and so forth. But their primary identity is they're a worker. They're a parent. They're a husband. They're a wife. They're a neighbor. They're a small business owner. That is their primary identity. And they're the ones paying the price. It's their hospitals that they have long waits in when a lot of people come into a place. It's their schools that get overcrowded. It's their labor markets that get flooded and that they have to find competition. And it's their communities that get destabilized and social services that get overrun. These people aren't coming to this country and moving to Beverly Hills. They're not coming to this country and moving to, as I said, the Upper West Side of Manhattan, or they're not moving to the Hamptons in the summer. They're moving into Hispanic communities that immediately pay the price for this chaos. And on top of that, they care about the things that matter to everyday people, the price of gas, schools trying to turn their sons into daughters. This notion that we can tax our way into prosperity and how much it costs to buy clothes. And all those things are being ignored by a Democratic Party. And that's why I think you're beginning to see this change in voting patterns. It's not because they're Hispanic. It's because they're working class.
Yeah, no, I agree. They're amongst the most pragmatic people around because they kind of have to be. You know, life, I worked construction in Southern California for over a decade. So pretty much all your coworkers are Hispanic. And they're a group like no other group. They start bringing their sons to the job when their sons are 12 and 13 and learning how to do plumbing and spread stucco and cinder block work and foundation work. Like they're very generational, very traditional, very hardworking, and would seem to be the opposite. You know, they're God-fearing, hardworking, family-oriented, you know, just really the opposite of everything the modern Democratic Party is pushing. So I don't know why they think this group is going to stay with them in perpetuity. And evidently they're not, and they found that out, and they're finding it out.
Because I think they confuse a labor leader or an immigration rights activist with the Hispanic community. And that's why I think they think the people who are the face of the immigration rights movement or claim to be the face of the immigration rights movement somehow are representative of the broader community. And listen, my parents were immigrants. I'm surrounded by my wife's parents were immigrants. I live in a community of immigrants. Miami-Dade County is majority immigrant. All my neighbors are. And at the end of the day, I know this experience firsthand, but there has to be a process for people to come here. And I would add this, it's also a working class voter. So a real world example of it is, again, speaking from personal experience and Hispanic background, one of the most tragic things that can happen in a working class Hispanic family is that a son or a daughter grows up, goes away to school, gets married and doesn't come back. And you only see him a couple times a year. I mean, that's like a catastrophe for them. And so they want your kids to succeed. They want you to find this great job and to pursue your dreams. But why can't you do it here in Miami? Right. Even though in Miami, we don't have the space industry. We don't have whatever, you know, Silicon Valley or what have you. And that's what you want to work in. So what's happening is as people are finding their kids are growing up, they're getting upwardly mobile, going to college, graduating, they can't afford to live in the community. They can't live there because the cost of living has gotten so high and they have to move away. And that's the kinds of things that people worry about on a daily basis. You want your family close to you. It matters to them. To them, the fact that you don't see your kids every day or every weekend is unthinkable. And it's your support network, right? In a working class, I know people that are working class and they can afford all kinds of things because they've made some money, but they're working class in their values. And the only people they'll leave their kids with is a cousin, you know, or an aunt or their grandmother to watch their kids. If somebody in my family can't watch your kids, you're not going on that trip. That's a very working class thing. And when you force people to move away from their family, it really makes it hard on them. And that's happening in a lot of parts of this country where the cost of living for a lot of young people has become prohibitive. They cannot start families. They can't afford to live in these communities. And they have to move. And that's part of the anxiety in a sense.
Does anything matter more than the safety of you and your loved ones? Well, of course not. So how come so many home security companies don't act like they care? Well, SimpliSafe does. I trust and recommend SimpliSafe. I've been using these guys for years. This stuff is sleek. It works. It's simple. Set it up yourself. No drilling holes, peel and stick. Batteries last up to 10 years. 24/7 professional monitoring. SimpliSafe's agents dispatch police, first responders, the moment a threat is detected. Even if you're not at home or can't be reached, $1 a day. No long-term contracts or hidden fees. Customize the perfect system for your home in just a few minutes at simplisafe.com/Adam. Go today for free indoor security camera plus 20% off with interactive monitoring at simplisafe.com/Adam. Do you own, do you rent your home? Sure you do. And it can be hard work. You know what's easy? Bundling your policies with Geico. Geico makes it easy to bundle your homeowners or renters insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing, too, because you have so much to do already around your home. Why not make it easy? Go to geico.com, get a quote, and see just how much you could save. It's Geico easy. Visit geico.com today. That's geico.com.
All month long, the biggest movies are streaming free on Pluto TV's Popcorn Summer Movies. Watch star-studded blockbusters like Titanic and Transformers Revenge of the Fallen. Or fall in love with charming rom-coms like Hitch and How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. The best part? Pluto TV is 100% free. No credit cards, not even a sign-up. Plus, Pluto TV has hundreds of channels with thousands more movies, TV shows, and more. Download the Pluto TV app on all your favorite devices and start streaming now. Pluto TV. Drop in, watch free.
For just $25, you get wine and gifts. Ace's favorite stuff or products from ACS. Every single month, you get the drink you choose. It's hard to beat cool stuff and booze. Adam's Monthly Nut.
People of Earth, it's time for another installment of Adam's Monthly Nut. This month, we got things that will take care of your body, soul, and scrotum. Like a sample pack of Tame the Beast Nut Butter, a blend with Tuck Everlasting anti-aging and anti-chafing ingredients that will keep your sack high and tight. We've also got the great Dano's Seasoning, who will make each and every kind of meat taste even better, whether it's beef, pork, or your fellow man. Dano's is low sodium and no sugar, so even Vinny will approve. We've also got Nude Mints to not only freshen your breath, but your gut biome too. These incredible products and a bottle of your choice can be found at CorollaDrinks.com for only $25. So prep your mails box. A new month of Adam's Monthly Nut has arrived.
Well, let's talk about some predictions for upcoming elections. A lot of people are talking about Gavin Newsom, my horrible governor in California, mainly because it seems like they're out of options, not because they think Gavin Newsom would make a great president, but more like it's more about Joe Biden is not going to run for a second term. Kamala Harris is, in my opinion, undone, whatever goodwill she may have had. I think what it was with Kamala Harris is people didn't really know her very well, and now we do know her, and she has torpedoed her own ship in terms of running for president because she's so wildly unpopular and seems borderline insane. Then there's like Bernie Sanders, old, and we've heard what he had to say. So I think they're kind of talking about Newsom. There's always this discussion about Michelle Obama coming out at the last second and running. On the Republican side, your name's thrown around. I think your name comes up. DeSantis comes up a lot. I think the Democrats are kind of worried about DeSantis. Of course, there's Trump. What if you break down the landscape? Tell me what you think.
I think it's impossible, and I'm not trying to be evasive. The politics today is so dynamic. The world is so dynamic. It's literally, if I had been sitting here with you 3 years ago, just 3 years ago, and I would have said, or let's go back 8 years, not even a decade, 8 years. And I would have said, over the next 8 years, here's what's going to happen. Donald Trump's going to become elected president of the United States. I'm talking about back in 2012 or 2013, maybe let's say 2014. Donald Trump's going to be president, and we're going to have this global pandemic that's going to shut everything down. And the Capitol is going to have on, you know, the January 6th of 2021 is going to be breached by people unhappy with the election result. And I can go on down the list. And we're going to live in a country where, you know, words have been changed and you can no longer use certain terms, where suddenly we're going to see in sports men that are clearly men competing against young women and winning, and everyone's pretending like, you know, there's no difference there. You would have said that's not possible. I mean, it's just not in 8 years that can all happen. That's what's happened in just the last 8 to 10 years. That's how much the world has changed. And I think you're going to see more of it, because what's happening is an era is ending, right? This post Cold War era, where everyone was told, guys, history's over. The Soviet Union collapsed. Everyone's going to become a democratic republic with free and free markets, and the free market's going to make everything perfect. That didn't work out. And now people are realizing, oh my God, countries actually have national identities. Like the Chinese, yeah, they care about the free market as long as it's good for China, because they're nationalist about China. And so many countries around the world are starting to figure out, hey, this free market stuff doesn't work for us. It works for us, except if we really need something and don't know how to make it, and the people who know how to make it won't send it to us. So the world's being reimagined. It's putting a lot of pressure. And in the process of all this, and listen, I hate socialism, so I think the free market is generally the right response to all this. But there are some things countries have to be able to make. And if you get rid of these things and you stop creating the jobs, not only are you dependent on a foreign country, you leave a lot of people stuck with no good jobs, you know, for them to have. And they're not at 49 years of age going to learn how to code and move to Silicon Valley and go work for a tech company. So that creates societal upheaval. So that's a long answer to a short question. The bottom line is, I don't know. I don't know, other than to tell you that I don't believe the Democratic Party, as of right now, I cannot identify someone that they're going to have to go through some painful losses to be able to reinvent themselves. And I, you know, I tell Republicans all the time, we're probably going to win a lot of elections in 2022. We should not assume it's because people love us and agree with us on everything. What we do have is an opportunity to create this new American consensus behind a new American majority of people who just want government to make common sense decisions that are focused on the priorities that matter to them. And one of those, I think, is to return as much power as we can to the place where it belongs. And that is to local governments and state governments, because those are leaders you can influence on a daily basis, as opposed to someone far away in Washington that's never even visited your community, much less represented.
What's your take on January 6th and where it's heading?
I think it was a bad thing. Yeah, listen, I think if people committed crimes on that day, they should be charged for it. They should be charged for it. I don't think that at the end of the day, you know, whether some people have been overcharged or undercharged, I don't know. I don't know the details of every person that came here. But you can't. We have rules. We're a law and order country. We believe in rule and quality under the law, and you've got to follow those rules. And it is simply illegal to storm into the United States Capitol and, you know, try to disrupt the function of government, even if you don't like the it's called chaos and anarchy. And I don't care whose side you're on, I'd be against it. The difference between me and some of my Democratic colleagues is they wouldn't say the same thing in summer of 2020 when there were people burning places in the streets and people were dying and police cars were being set on fire and over 1,000 police officers were injured and people died. And, you know, it was one of the largest loss of property in American history with the arson and all this sort of thing. They weren't saying it for that. We've had no hearings on that and on what that was all about. In fact, we were told that that was what happens when people are unhappy. And that was the language of people who were desperate and people who were treated unjustly. And it just wasn't so. I mean, there were people marching during the day, and I didn't agree with what they were saying about defund the police. But the people that were showing up at night were a totally different group. These were anarchists, fascists, haters, hate America, and they were trying to burn places down and harm people, and nothing was done about it. And that's the difference between me and the other side. I think it's wrong to do that. I'm against political violence. We have a republic and we have elections to decide these things. And I'll say it no matter whose side you were on or who you voted for. The other side won't do that. They won't do that.
Well, famously, I'll ask my producer, Chris, to find that Nancy Pelosi statues thing. People are going to do what they're going to do. I haven't heard it in a little while. Maybe you haven't heard it, but To make your point, Marco Rubio, the fact that at some point somebody said to Nancy Pelosi, what about people tearing down these statues? Like, shouldn't we vote on this? Shouldn't we have a you know, OSHA-approved team show up with hard hats and, you know, tape and a skip loader. Like, we're just having crazy people with ropes and skateboards show up and tear these things down in the middle of the night. And her response was, people are going to do what people are going to do. And I remember thinking, man, that is insane. It's insane that you can't even condemn people that are tearing down statues. By the way, it's pretty dangerous to take, you know, 3 tons of bronze and pull it down with a jump rope on top of yourself. That she couldn't even just say, yeah, you can't do that. We have to figure out whether we want this to stay or not. You're not allowed to lynch a statue, in other words. She wouldn't even condemn people tearing down statues in the middle of the night. She just announces people are going to do what people are going to do.
You know, they've gone around for 2 years talking about how evil these people on the Supreme Court are. Like, they're, some of them have even accused them of being sort of the new American Taliban and some of the, or American Taliban equivalent. So a guy gets on an airplane, flies halfway across the country with the clear intent of murdering Justice Kavanaugh. And now we learn at least one or two other justices to fundamentally change the court. It was a news story for a day or day and a half, but we haven't had the, you know, the obligatory CNN 2-hour special investigation report, you know, documentary. We haven't had the breathless. I mean, I'm talking about an assassination, like a targeted assassination. Nothing. We heard about it. It was reported barely. And then it's been talked about a little bit, but it has not dominated the news. And I think that's a very significant thing that happened. And we still have people once, twice a week outside the homes of Supreme Court justices protesting. Not only is it illegal to try to influence and intimidate a judge into making a decision, but it's also a nuisance. And the governors of the state of Maryland and Virginia, not Virginia, Maryland have allowed it. They've allowed it. It continues. And now even the neighbors who are pro-choice or whatever are complaining about it because these are nasty people saying terrible things. Their kids can't go out. It's that double game, right? There's two rules and it depends. If you're on the right or what they identify as the right, then these things are deserved and they're not going to condemn it. If it's on the other side, then they're not going to say much about it. They'll either ignore it or in some cases justify it. And, you know, I think people see through it. I really do. I think people see through it. I think I can't describe to you how powerful the bubble that the force field in Washington is. These people live here, they work here, and they think the rest of the country is thinking and talking about what we're talking about and focused on what they're talking about right now and agree with them. They think that their positions are majority positions and their priorities are majority priorities. They are not. They are not. And that's what elections remind them of that every 2 years.
We have the clip. This is from 2020. She's commenting on the tearing down of the Christopher Columbus statue.
So I have that pride, but I don't care that much about statues.
Shouldn't that be done by a commission or the city council, not a mob in the middle of the night throwing it into the harbor?
People will do what they do.
This is an elected official. This is third in line to be the president, basically saying, she starts by saying, like, well, I'm Italian, but, you know, I don't really care about statues, by the way. And we're not talking about statues. We're talking about law and order.
They do care about statues because they've removed statues from statutory and replaced them. And by the way, I have a problem. We just recently did it where we replaced a former Confederate general with a woman in Florida who's one of a great leader, one of the great leaders, founded a great university. No problem with that. But they do care about statues. The problem with the statue thing is like the cultural revolution that happened in China. Eventually, you know, like the leaders of the revolution, people, they turned on them because you end up eventually running out of people to take to the guillotine. And so end up turning on, you know, on the guy that operates the guillotine and because you're running out of people to execute and behead. And that's what happens. I mean, this hysteria, I think the last I checked, they're up to Woodrow Wilson. And I think they'll just keep moving back. And at some point, I think they'll work their way through the Old Testament as well.
It's just insane that a reporter talked about a mob showing up in the middle of the night and taking these statues down. And her answer is people are going to do what they're going to do. She couldn't have been more dismissive. And the part that fascinates me is just a study of human behavior is, clearly you're partisan. I get it. But once in a while, a line gets crossed and you do what you do and what many Republicans have done when they're discussing January 6th and what you just did, which is you go, it's, you know, I don't think Trump should be locked up for telling people to peacefully and patriotically march and then not jumping on it. I don't know what it was, 180 minutes later, whatever the number is. But you still always say it is not okay for these people to do this, meaning Nancy Pelosi could have said, that's not okay. I disagree with a lot of these statues. I think some of this stuff represents a past that we shouldn't be glorifying, but it's not okay to walk onto federal land and take matters in your own hand. They can't even do that. They can't take half a step backwards and just not condone something that's so clearly definable.
Yeah, so the nation, the what I think we've lost is the concept of what a nation is. At its core, what a nation is people who are not, maybe don't agree on everything, but the one thing they agree on is they agree to live together under the same rules. And they have a process for deciding what those rules are. And they may not be 100% what you want those rules to be, but you have a process. And as long as your voice is heard and you have a chance to influence it and maybe change it in the future, you agree to live under the same set of rules. Where you lose a nation is when one group says, well, we believe that we should be a people who all live under the set of rules that I decide. And if we don't get the rules that I want, then I'm prepared to tear down this whole thing and start over again until we end up with the rules I want and people like you stop trying to change them. That's where you lose a country. That's the core of revolutions. It's people that do not agree to live under the same set of rules, so they want to rewrite it. And so, again, I'm not trying to exaggerate where we are, but in many cases, that's where we are. We are having a debate about whether we should have the same set of rules and abide by those same set of rules, irrespective of who ended up winning the last debate on that topic. Because you can survive bad decisions made by politicians. What you cannot survive is tearing apart the fabric of what makes us a nation. And that's what they're tearing apart. They are literally telling us we're actually not one people. The most important identity that any of us have is our gender identity, the color of our skin, where our parents came from, our ethnicity, the intersectionality of all these things, whatever the hell that means. That's the most important thing about us. The American piece, that's just what our passport says. But really the most important thing about us is that. And that's just un-American. Literally, that is as un-American as you can get, because what makes you an American is it doesn't matter what the color of your skin is. It doesn't matter where your parents came from. Here, you're an American. It's because you have equal rights, because we all have rights given to us by our creator. And we have laws to protect those rights, even if you're in the minority, be it an ethnic minority or a political minority. That's what America is. And these people are literally arguing the opposite. Identity politics is one of the most un-American things that exist, because it asks us to separate from one another and view each other as competitors as opposed to countrymen.
Well, it's also super destructive to the people you claim to care about the most. It's
toxic.
The most harmful thing you can do to a community is tell them they're not welcome. They have a target on their back. Nobody wants them in this country. I mean, it's the most destructive thing you could do to a child. What if you just said to a kid, look, you're not welcome on the schoolyard because you look different than the other kids and they all hate you. And some of them will say it to your face, but everyone is thinking it. And they're scared of people that look different than them. And that kid would kill himself by the time he got to the eighth grade. It's insanely destructive. I don't know if they know what they're doing or they don't care. There's no evidence it works. It takes these groups that they claim are marginalized and marginalizes them even more because of the psychological damage they do to these people with this never-ending drumbeat of the cops have it in for you, the teachers have it in for you, the society, systemic racism. It's so insanely destructive. It's super condescending. There's so many examples of people in this country from every race achieving in this country through, you know, dedication, hard work, grit, and all that good stuff. It's just insane that it's 2022 and they're beating that drum even harder now.
Yeah, so a couple things I'd say. First of all, is there racism in America? Of course there is, unfortunately, because there's racism in every society in the history of mankind. It is part of our fallen nature that we immediately discriminate against people for a variety of reasons, race being one of them, but there's others. Every culture, every society has had that, unfortunately. I think what separated us from that is, from many of those societies, is in America we actually think it's wrong. It's wrong. This is a country where not even the racists want to be called racists. because it's wrong and we look down upon it. The second point I would make to you is that one of the greatest gifts that my parents gave me, I didn't have a trust fund. I didn't hear my dad was a bartender. My mom was a clerk at Kmart, a cashier at a hotel. I mean, I didn't inherit a penny from my parents. But the one thing I did inherit was they made sure that I knew that I lived in the one place on earth where it didn't matter that he was a bartender and she was a maid. It didn't matter that they were immigrants. I could be anything I wanted to be. It was based on whether I was good enough to do it and whether I was willing to do the work. Now, you know, could I play in the NBA? No, I couldn't. That wasn't where my talent was. But if I was good at something or had the ability to do something and I was willing to work on it, you know, I would have a real chance, not a illusory chance, a real chance to succeed. And that was the greatest gift my parents gave us. I honestly grew up my whole life believing. Do I believe there are people out there that pass judgment on me over time or whatever because they had a prejudice? I'm sure. But I was too busy getting ahead to worry about those people and to think about it. And I think that the opposite is corrosive. It's destructive. Because when you start telling a child from the youngest of age, the most important thing about you is the color of your skin or where your parents came from. You're basically telling them, listen, most of what's going to happen in your life is completely out of your control. And that not only is it destructive, it should be untrue, but it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yes.
And it violates everything this country is about. Even our civil rights movement was not about that. People forget our civil rights movement was not a call to reject our founding documents. Martin Luther King's challenge was to fulfill our founding documents. He spoke about it in speeches where he said, live up to the magnificent words of that Declaration of Independence. You're not living up to who you say you are. He didn't say tear that up because it was written by a bunch of racist white men who owned slaves. He said, those are magnificent words. The people who wrote them were imperfect creatures of their time, but the words were magnificent. Live up to them. And that was at the essence of the civil rights movement. That's not what you hear today. And that, unfortunately, is something that needs to change. And I don't believe the majority of Americans want that either. But that's what these guys have made the prominent feature of their agenda.
What do you think about Biden? Do you think he will finish out his first term? A lot of people were always talking about, you know, is he running for a second term? And I always kind of raised my hand and said, I'm not sure if he's getting through this one. I certainly don't think there's a second one, but I do not know if he's getting through this one or not. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, let me say a couple of things. I'm a little bit old fashioned in the following way, and that is that I don't like to talk about the deficiencies of a president because I actually think that emboldens and encourages an adversary to maybe do things they wouldn't normally do, and that wouldn't be good for America. That said, I also can't insult people's intelligence. Now, I didn't work with Joe. I wasn't with Joe Biden in the Senate, but I knew him as vice president. I've interacted with him in the past on a number of things. It's not the same guy. Now, few people are, you know, after at this stage in their life. That now, so I don't know what I'm not opining on his health. I'm just saying he's not the same person. I think that's pretty clear, and I think that's normal and natural when you reach your late 70s and early 80s. And I think that's what people are. The difference is most people aren't president at that age. The second point I would make is that. If he wasn't running for president, he would still have to say he was. He would be saying the exact same thing he's saying right now if he wasn't running, because no one wants to be a one-term lame duck president. The minute you announce you're not running, the Democratic primary kicks off and you become less relevant. So he almost has to say it, irrespective of whether he's going to run or not. I have no idea whether he plans to run again or not. I have no clue, but I don't know what's going to happen in terms of whether he runs or not. I see the polling. I hear the murmurs. We'll see how that plays out. Again, it ties into this very unusual situation that we now have where we have a former president that may be running again. We have a sitting president that may not run again. We may have two former presidents running against each other, which we haven't had in a long time. Anything like that happen. We may have people running that we've never heard of or never thought of before. I mean, there's going to be a lot of people entering politics over the next 10 years that have never held office and no one knows who they are today. I almost think that's an advantage given how people look at the political class and rightfully so. So it's a very unpredictable and dynamic period. We've had about three of those in our time in our country. If you look at three eras, the ends of eras are always sort of turbulent. And then, you know, the country reestablishes a common sense sort of consensus. And that governs the next 20, 30, 40 years of that country. And the political movements sort of find their place within those barriers. But I'll tell you what, it's been a heck of a ride so far.
Yeah, my thing with Joe Biden is I am not really trying to be partisan or disrespectful. I'm sort of looking at it like he's a quarterback for the football team, and it looks like he slowed down quite a bit. His knees may be bad, and people are saying, oh, yeah, he's got two more years on his contract. And I'm just sort of saying, I don't know if he's going to be quarterbacking 2 years from now for this team. And they're going, he's got two and a half more years on his contract. And I'm going, yeah, I know, but I'm watching him play, and I'm kind of wondering if he gets all the way through the contract. But you brought up Trump. And then there's the kind of whole Trump-DeSantis thing, which is interesting. I don't know if you're Trump or Team DeSantis or where you land on that, but thoughts on that. Obviously, many news outlets are doing hit pieces on DeSantis now because they probably feeling that he poses a threat. But what do you think?
Well, I have no clue what either one of them is going to do whatsoever. I know that Ron DeSantis is 100, and he doesn't. It's not really a talking point. I really know for a fact, because I happen to be on the ballot at the same time, that he's deeply focused on winning the gubernatorial race in Florida and doesn't take it for granted. Remember, this guy just 4 years ago, and I was around at that time and tried to be helpful to him at that time. He won a very close race by 30,000 votes. We came 30,000 votes away from having a governor that now is a guy who's under indictment. But so it was a close race. So I think when you go through an experience like that, you don't take anything for granted. What he'll do afterwards, I don't know. I think some of this stuff, frankly, a lot of it is manufactured, because what we forget is we have an entire industry now that's built around politics as entertainment. And that didn't exist maybe 50 years. I mean, Walter Cronkite, whatever. Those guys weren't entertainers. They did the nightly newscast. Now you have 24-hour cable news and multiple outlets and online, and it's all about politics. And politics is covered like entertainment. And it's about outrage and scandal and pushing buttons and getting the clicks and driving the traffic. And these political stories drive that. That doesn't mean that there's nothing there, that there wouldn't be if you ran a rivalry of some sort, because that certainly would be rivals. But I think part of this is accelerated and exacerbated by the need to cover it from a political dynamic. These are not policy reporters, they're political reporters, and they love the horse race, and they love to write articles that speculate. There's no accountability if they're 100% wrong about it in their predictions. But that people like to read that stuff. They like to watch that stuff. And so it drives a lot of it. But this will settle out. Again, it's kind of part of this unusual environment that we're facing. I don't stand anywhere on it because it's not real. I focus on real problems, not theoretical ones. And who knows what the world's going to look like in 6 months or 9 months and what decisions people make. But I can tell you, I don't know what the future is going to look like, but it isn't going to look like what we think it's going to look like. That I'm pretty certain of.
How's Florida? Well, I guess I should, before we run out of time, bring up China, since China keeps popping up in the news.
Yeah.
Many people whose opinions I trust have been sort of talking about China for a long time. We've been talking about Russia, but everyone else is, the people that seem to know a little more seem to be talking about China. And now recently we're talking about China. What do you feel the trajectory of China is vis-a-vis the relationship with this country?
Well, it'll define the 21st century, the relationship with the United States and China. I think where we're headed, and we'll probably see it much clearer here in the next 18 months, is a world in which there's sort of a pro-democracy bloc led by America and our European and Asian allies, a Chinese-led bloc with Russia as a junior partner, and then dozens and dozens of developing countries sort of trying to leverage both sides, get benefits from both sides. We'll buy weapons from these guys, we'll get oil from them, we want your tourists, but we want your agriculture, and trying to leverage us against each other. And that happened a little bit in the Cold War. That's the world we're headed towards. China is the most comprehensive, near peer competitor the nation's ever faced. The Soviet Union was a military competitor and a geopolitical and ideological competitor. They were never a commercial competitor. They were never an industrial competitor or a technological competitor of the United States. China is. And they are for two reasons. First, we've allowed them to cheat for 30 years because there are a bunch of smart people around here thought, well, don't worry, when the Chinese get rich, they'll become just like us. And then we woke up one day and said, oh, my God, they are rich. They got rich by stealing our stuff, but they've also gotten pretty good at it themselves. And now we are in competition against them. And they don't have to have a town hall meeting. I'm not in favor of dictatorship. But when they decide we're going to do something, they go after it. Right. They don't have to have a long debate about it. They just do it. And they put a bunch of money behind it. And they start by stealing your intellectual property as their starting point, so that they can build up from there. So they intend to be, they view the world, this is an ancient civilization. They view the last 100 years as an aberration. And they believe that they are naturally destined to be the most powerful nation on earth, and that America is a hollowed out, once great power in decline. That's how they view things. And they think that what's happening now is just a temper tantrum of a dying superpower. And that's a very dangerous thing, because they may not understand our system, right? One of the things that concerned me is that they thought, because I criticized Nancy Pelosi so much, that somehow I would clap or be happy if they brought harm to her on her trip to Taiwan, and they would be wrong. I think that you would see Americans immediately unite and say, look, we have big differences in our domestic politics, but she's an American. If you harm her, the people that are with her, we're gonna have a problem. And I fear that they misunderstand our divisions as something that, look, the Japanese made that conclusion. One of the reasons why the Japanese attacked the Pearl Harbor is because they thought Americans were not just isolationists and didn't care about the rest of the world, but that Americans were too busy dancing to jazz and drinking to actually fight. And they were wrong. And they paid a terrible price for it. The world did. So I fear that a lot. I really do. And I think it's really important for us to wake up to the reality that China poses that threat. And a lot of what we have to do about it is with ourselves. We've got to be a country that can make things again. Even if it's cheaper to make it somewhere else, there are things there are certain things we have to be able to make in this country, like medicine, like grow our own food, like some electronic components, like rare earth minerals. And if we can't make it, then one of our allies better be able to make it. Because if we depend on China for it, they will use it as leverage against us. They already do.
Marco Rubio, thank you for carving out some time and giving us all your opinions. Website, MarcoRubio.com is where you go. And hope to see you in person next time I get out to Florida, Marco.
Absolutely. Thank you.
MarcoRubio.com. Thank you, Senator. Appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
So until next time, this is Adam Carolla for Marco Rubio saying mahalo.
Make sure you get a copy of Adam's new book, Everything Reminds Me of Something, Advice, Answers, But No Apologies. The hard copy and audiobook are available wherever finer books are sold. Leave us a voicemail at 888-634-1744 and get your tickets to see the Ace Man. Get them right now at adamcarolla.com.
You own, you rent your home? Sure you do. And it can be hard work. You know what's easy? Bundling your policies with Geico. Geico makes it easy to bundle your homeowners or renters insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing, too, because you have so much to do already around your home. Why not make it easy? Go to geico.com, get a quote, and see just how much you could save. It's Geico easy. Visit geico.com today. That's geico.com.
All month long, the biggest movies are streaming free on Pluto TV's Popcorn Summer Movies. Watch star-studded blockbusters like Titanic and Transformers Revenge of the Fallen. Or fall in love with charming rom-coms like Hitch and How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. The best part? Pluto TV is 100% free. No credit cards, not even a sign-up. Plus, Pluto TV has hundreds of channels with thousands more movies, TV shows, and more. Download the Pluto TV app on all your favorite devices and start streaming now. Pluto TV. Drop in, watch free.